I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, the Spider-Verse Proliferates edition. It's Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. On today's show, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. It's the sequel to Into the Spider-Verse, the Wild Bebop variation on the Spider-Man canon. It's about a Brooklyn kid somewhere in the multiverse who is not Peter Parker, but is Spider-Man. This is a sequel, of course. It made buckets of money this past weekend. And then Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen star in Platonic, a sitcom on Apple TV about two not-same-sex buddies reuniting in midlife. And finally, we discuss the huge hit video game The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom with Slate's own Luke Winkie. Joining me today is Julia Turner of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, the film critic of Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Good morning, Stephen.
Should we make a show?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is the sequel to Into the Spider-Verse. We're about a year after the action of that first film with Gwen, voiced by Hailee Steinfeld, and Miles, voiced by Shameik Moore, back in their respective universes when worlds begin to interpenetrate wildly, as they do in kind of string-theorized world-building IP. In this instance, thanks in part to a secret spider society that polices action between the disparate realms of reality, much exquisite mayhem ensues. The film also stars Jorma Taccone and Oscar Isaac. In the clip we're about to hear, Miles is in a meeting with his parents and a teacher to go over his grades in the early parts of a college admissions process. Let's have a listen.
Miles's grades are pretty good. A in AP Physics.
That's my little man.
And AP Studio Art.
He takes after his uncle.
A minus in English.
She's a tough grader.
And a B in Spanish.
What?
Ooh, okay.
Miles.
Are you trying to tell your mother?
Cálmate, mami. Eso no es my fault.
¿Qué es eso que esto no es mi fault? ¿Tú estás tomando una clase en Spanish?
Mom, I just missed a few classes.
Oh, just a few classes. Well, what's a few?
I mean, you know, like five?
Five?
Actually, six.
You're dead.
You're dead. All right, Dana, let's start with you. That gives a nice flavor of the early parts of the film, at least. What'd you make of this? It made, I think I said, up tippy-top, it made tons of money. It's a big hit already. What'd you think of it?
I mean, I really hate in a way that you're asking me first, because I think I'm going to be the least enthusiastic of the three of us about it. But that said, it is, what would the word be? Kind of hypnotic, like the first, you know, like the first movie from 2018. It is, it's extremely original in its visual style, and that never gets tiring. The beauty of this movie remains vibrant all the way through. Whether it needs to be 2 hours and 20 minutes long, and whether it needs to end on a cliffhanger, promising another Spider-Man Spider-Verse movie in some unspecified number of years, is another question. And I couldn't help feeling a little bit as if I was being trapped, to use a web metaphor, as if I was being sort of caught into a content web, in spite of the originality and beauty and sincerity and humor and, you know, great performances and just so many things that this movie gets right and does in its own original way. I still couldn't help but feel as if I was being fed content that was going to be doled out in more future installments. And I do think I'm just feeling a resentment toward the entire Marvel industrial complex, even at its upper echelons, of which this is definitely an example, right? I mean, it has Chris Miller and Philip Lord, the pair, the animating pair behind the Lego movie, among other things. And it has that kind of wit and visual snap and humor and great cameos from actors. And it is very fun moment to moment and very fun to watch with a big audience with kids who are enjoying it for sure. But I'm not quite sure in the case of either of these two movies that I get into the rhapsodic accolades that some others do. But please shut me up with some rhapsodic accolades.
Julia, this is in what Dana says is in, I would say, pointed contrast to the first one, a shorter movie, totally unexpected, wildly original. It didn't feel like a cynical exploitation of IP, really, to, I think, anybody. It was a celebration of comic books, on and on and on and on. But not this one, according to Dana. What about to you?
I mean, just the absolute visual originality of the storytelling. And I guess it's both original and, you know, deeply elusive and referential in that it's pulling from a varieties of comic books, varieties of art history, varieties of animation styles. I will forgive this movie a lot because of how fascinating and beautiful and fun it is to watch. It's 2 hours and 19 minutes, and it's you feel it. And when it, you know, it was, I think, originally called Across the Spider-Verse Part 1, which may give you a suggestion as to how the film ends, which may be shaping part of our response to it. I think it does shape mine a bit. But I really loved it. I mean, in addition to all of the visual gorgeousness of it, the thing I admire about it is how grounded it is in its human relationships, which feel both dimensional and like the point. And I also think the film is doing really fun things. Perhaps it's possible to find them to be a little bit too glib and clever, but it is at once a, you know, gigantic expression of comic book pop culture.
Yeah.
But it's pretty critical of some of the dark currents in comic book pop culture. And without spoiling too much of it, it sort of sets up kind of obsessive fanboy desires to adhere to canon or the way things always were as perhaps something to be concerned about and something that can be calcifying and trapping and anti-human, which is like a pretty interesting set of points for a movie based on comic book IP to be making. And then I think it's really just like a beautiful movie about love and families and self-confidence. And it sort of uses the fact of the multiverse it's describing as a way to tell a human story, as opposed to populating various multiverses with thin shadows of humans in order to get us to watch explosions.
Yeah.
And, you know, the history of Spider-Man and Marvel and how the Spider-Man movies came to be made by Sony and not Marvel and how that all is getting reconciled over time is a long story, probably not for this show, but you can feel the differential DNA here, I think.
I would agree with that. I mean, I don't at all mean to say, oh, this is just more of the same and I'm sick of the same old thing. This is definitely a fresh twist on the same old thing. And I think if that is your thing, this could be a really exciting exploration of, but to me, I guess I just feel like even the hero's journey, like, great, you're questioning the hero's journey, but what about those of us who have already been over the hero's journey for a long time?
Yeah, for a long time. Well, I want to just say, I think I agree with every word both of you said, and now I have to try to reconcile how that's possible. I mean, the visual creativity, and I agree with Julia, the basic credible humanity of these characters, I think goes beyond, well beyond anything they've been able to do in a live action format. I loved the first one for being uncynical and relatively brief by the standards of this. Here's where I agree with both of you. I loved this movie almost unreservedly for about an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half. It is too long and overstuffed. And the cynicism, I'm afraid, did leak into this picture despite its real, real virtues. And then it becomes the kind of careening, frenetic, somewhat directionless, non-film film that Marvel movies are. When they expand out, the fight sequences are eternal. They go on and on and on. They're quite boring. You get lost in space and the plot disappears and the human drama disappears for way too long at a time. And then I didn't know it was part one. And so it begins to recohere again because it knows it has to leave you. It needs something as old-fashioned as plot to get you to the cliff off of which to hang that forces you to come back into the theater. And they're very deft at that. And they do. They recohere the characters and the plot and the arc. And suddenly I was back in it again. But I was like, how the fuck are they going to wrap this up in the next 30 seconds? Ah, oh, fuck you. Right. The groan in that theater when To Be Continued, like, I don't think very many people in that theater knew it was coming. And they were like, what the?
Yeah, there were audible come ons.
Yeah, come on. It was like,
Oh. And it's a reel to be continued. It's not sort of like, oh, there's more to be mined from these characters and story. It's like a suspenseful arc is chopped off so that everybody can pay $18 more in 3 years. And that just feels, I guess if you were really, really in it, that would feel like a fun challenge or something. But again, I just felt a little bit IP milked at the end. And I think some of the kids in the theater where I saw it felt the same.
Well, here's one way that I would look at it, because ironically, this movie, which is maybe one of my favorite I've seen in the last 18 months, mm-hmm. had the ending absolutely completely in common with my most abjectly hated film we've seen in the last 18 months, which was Avatar 2, The Way of Water, Part 1, or whatever the heck it was, which had an extremely similar, like, the whole movie with its stupid seaweed bikinis was just like getting everybody ready to have the fight. And I was like, come, what? Like, what? So it's somehow being pulled out of this like incredibly beautiful, sensitive, soulful, stylish, inventive, non-sexist, non-ogling, non-13-year-old boy, like very wise, like emotionally smart and gorgeous universe, like totally different viewing experience. Mm. And then to womp have the same ending. I was like, ugh. But I think probably what's going on there, just this is a guess, but I think it's similar, which is that both sets of creators on these two films are doing something really, really technically difficult with their storytelling. Mm-hmm. And feel like, hey, what even is a movie versus an episode versus a like all these movies now are basically episodes in one gigantic unending TV show. And like, I'm here trying to make my, you know, beautiful, gorgeous, painterly, you know, Gwen is feeling an emotion. And so suddenly the whole scene is like throbbing in this emotive purple and gorgeously, and or like I must perfectly, you know, retouch the seaweed frond on this blue fish tween's boob, whatever it is that you're doing in the like deep art animation studio. You're like, this is so gorgeous. Everyone needs more of it. And I'm just going to keep unfurling it. And who cares about what the classic satisfying arc of like sitting in a movie theater for 90 to 180 minutes is? Like, I, you know, it just seems, it seems like maybe when you're trying to make something heavily effects based or animated, and you're trying to make it unusually gorgeous, you just kind of get a little lost or something, and you know you've got another one coming. Like, you just aren't thinking that the audience cares whether it has all the usual beats of a satisfying experience, because it's everything's mushed together. Like, why not watch a TV show, one episode of a TV show in a movie theater this year and watch the next episode in 3 years? Like, I guess. It just felt deflating.
Yeah, really deflating. I mean, first of all, let me just say up front that seaweed bikini abject hating Julia Turner is the best Julia Turner. Your hatred.
I will start a whole side podcast that's just like a frame by frame takedown of that. Like, I actually, guys, this is my last show. Welcome to Avatar 2, the Julia verse.
I'd jump the paywall. Yeah. Dana, I'm going to give you a shot here, because I know you must have admired things about this movie, like Oscar Isaac. There are all these great performances and characters. You admired things about this movie, yes?
So one of the positive things I'll say about this movie is that I agree with its reception. I'm happy that it's been joyously received and that kids are going back to see it twice. And in that sense, I have nothing but good things to say about Across the Spider-Verse. It may not be my particular thing, but I honestly don't think for the most part it is made in a vein of cynicism. Julia's already spoken to the visual beauty and the palette and all of that. I mean, the playfulness with imagery is incredible. If you know something about comic book history more than I do, it's even more so, you know, from, you know, the sort of tiny dots on the characters' faces as if they were printed from an old-fashioned dot printer to, you know, the styles changing when they flip into different universes. And then the voice work, we haven't talked about all the cameos mm-hmm. and the great voices that appear. And the reason I sat through the credits was because I wanted to hear if the people that I thought were doing voices were doing voices. And one of the big mysteries to me was, who is Spider-Punk, who is this new character who appears, who's basically animated like the illustration on a Sex Pistols cover. He's sort of like a moving version of that, you know, very, very Malcolm McLaren styled dude. And it was Daniel Kaluuya, who you never get to hear talk in his native British accent, right? I mean, most of the big roles we know him for, he's playing an American. So I didn't guess it was his voice, but he's incredible. Oscar Isaac is very funny. There's just tons of playfulness in every corner. And so in spite of the fact that I, by the 2 hour and 20 minute mark, was saying enough trippy psychedelic action montages, I cannot watch one more moment of people hurtling through rainbow colored portals, I was still delighted by the voice work and the just the joy that everyone seemed to bring to it. Like, nobody behind the mic doing their voice, Jason Schwartzman as this very inventive villain who's sort of like a walking black hole, nobody seemed to be just phoning it in behind the mic. Everyone was having fun.
All right, it's Across the Spider-Verse. It's in movie theaters. It's in a multiplex playing every 30 seconds. Go check it out.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Before we go any further, this is typically where we discuss business. Dana, what do we have this week?
Steve, we have two items of business this week. Exciting suspense after the first to find out what the second one is. First of all, it is time, now that it's June, this is our first show recorded in June, I believe, time to start planning for our annual Summer Strut episode. For listeners who might be new to the show and not know this, every summer we ask listeners to send us some of their favorite catchy, upbeat songs, the kind of songs that set you strutting down the sidewalk in the summer. We compile a playlist of them, we choose our favorites, and we bring on Slate's great pop critic and chartologist Chris Malanfi to talk about the songs with us. So if you want to contribute to the Summer Strut playlist this year, please email us your links at culturefest@slate.com. Send us the name of the song and the artist. Better yet, you could send a Spotify link directly to the song and we'll add it to our huge playlist. I mean, these playlists are giant. We take a few weeks to listen our way through them a few times and make sub-playlists of our favorites and discuss them on our Summer Strut episode, which will probably be in July or August, depending on our vacation scheduling and how long we can listen to the list for. Again, send your catchy summary suggestions to culturefest@slate.com. They don't have to be songs about summer, just songs that give you that summer feeling, to quote Jonathan Richman. Our second item of business this week is to tell you all about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're answering a listener question. Our listener named Talia wrote in to know, what is our relationship to our finished work? In other words, do you feel a big sense of accomplishment after you've completed something, or just anxiety and regret about everything you could have done differently? Talia says this question was prompted by an experience she had with a big thesis project that she recently completed. Congratulations. We thought this was a great question, so we're going to ponder it in our Slate Plus segment at the end of the show. If you belong to Slate Plus, you will hear that after the regular show. And if you don't, you can sign up at slate.com/culture plus. In exchange for your membership, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus content like the segment I just described, and you get unlimited access to all of the wonderful writing on Slate. You'll never hit a paywall when you belong to Slate Plus, and you'll also be supporting us and the work of our wonderful colleagues. These memberships are what keeps Slate going, so please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. All right, back to the show.
What's it like to no longer be so young in a youth-obsessed culture, to be besieged from within by all the counterfactuals and regrets of middle age? In Platonic, the new sitcom on Apple TV, Rose Byrne is Sylvia, an ex-lawyer and now mother of three, who reunites with her old buddy Will, played by Seth Rogen. He's a brewmaster, part owner of a pub, and a middle-aged man-boy. He's fun, he's juvenile, averse to conformity, blithe about money, and he re-enlivens her life. But their camaraderie begins to irritate some of their other intimates. In this clip, you'll hear the voices of Rogen and Byrne. They're a little bit drunk in this scene, and they're arguing about why their friendship initially ended. Let's have a listen.
I was in love, and I just wanted you to support me. That's all I wanted.
I was just being honest because I love you, and you didn't want to hear it, so you ditched me.
I ditched you because it's hard to be friends with someone who you know hates your wife.
Isn't honesty what you want from your closest friends?
No, not when it's bad.
And he didn't love Audrey, but you didn't hold that against him, did you? What's that about?
It's different with men than it is with women. Men.
Oh, fuck.
They're more mellow about this shit.
Ridiculous. And it's fucking bullshit, and it's insulting.
Sometimes the truth is insulting. Men are more mellow.
That doesn't make any sense. Yeah, men are really mellow. You know who starts wars? Men. You think George W. Bush was really fucking mellow when he invaded Iraq?
Ever heard of Mary, Queen of Scots?
Please tell me one thing about Mary, Queen of Scots.
Bloody Mary. That's what they call her, and you don't get that name by being mellow. Margaret Thatcher, she was a fucking asshole. That Cara Delevingne, she seems like a fucking mess.
All right, I'm going to start with Julia here. What'd you make of these two and their show?
Any excuse to see Rose Byrne as a comedian, I will take. Like, I wish that somehow her career had lined up with, like, I don't know, whichever heydays of Hollywood provided the best fodder for comedians. She's so fucking funny. I really enjoy her in comedic roles. I am not certain that I think this show is fully worthy of her efforts. Like, it's a good hang. It's pleasant. It's chaotic. It's fun. Sure. That's my response. Tepid and pleasantry. I don't know. It seemed fine. It seemed a little baggy and a little shapeless to me. I am very curious, though, what Dana, our resident completist of the show, thought.
I think I'm much more fond of it than you, Julia. I mean, I agree. Rose Byrne is great in comedian roles. She also has great chemistry with Seth Rogen. She's already played his wife twice in the two Neighbors movies, directed by Nicholas Stoller, who co-created this series. And this is just kind of a hangout show, but I think it's a really good hangout show. In fact, I wrote an entire, I'm not usually a TV critic, but I wrote on this series for Slate because I wanted it to get some recognition amidst all the zillions of streaming comedies that are being dumped on us constantly. I think this one is actually worth finishing, if only because it remains pretty much in that hangout mode. You know, it doesn't become a rom-com, really. It has the structure of a rom-com in that it's about relationships and domestic comedy situations. But it really is a show that asks questions about friendship that I found, I don't know, maybe this just happens to speak to my little world, but the idea of an old friend from your more intense party days of your youth coming into your middle-aged life, right, after you have a family or have a career or both and are figuring out what the second half of your life is going to be, is kind of identifiable. And I think watching these two mess up their lives together in a way that seemed at both kind of comedically ridiculous and sort of psychologically plausible was really a satisfying hang with a lot of good side characters too. And I don't know, it's not that often that I finish one of these streaming shows, to be honest. It's a rare thing when we watch something for this podcast that I want to watch every single episode of the show. And I did with Platonic. Steve, what about you? Settle the tie.
Team Julia. I almost wanted to recuse myself because I think, as you all know, my wrist was once touched tenderly by Rose Byrne and I've never been the same since. But anyway, I consulted a team of lawyers. We worked together. We drafted some paperwork and I'm allowed to do the segment. And I just think she's a flawless creature, one aspect of which is that she's an incredible comedic actress, Julia, exactly as you say. I'd love to have seen her in the 1930s alongside Claudette Colbert and Why am I not thinking of who's the Rosalind Russell, but who's the other one from My Man Godfrey, my favorite of all of them? Who is it?
Carol Lombard?
Yeah, Carol Lombard. She's, to me, she's in that class, right? I think, and what I, you know, it scarcely needs to be said, right? She has this, and this is not at all a backhanded compliment, she has a China doll beauty to her, and she plays against it, and that is her essence coming out, right? Her, she's telling you in most of what she's done as a comedian that her essence isn't the China doll at all. It's this ferociously funny, self-undermining, you know, ironic, you know, ironist in some way. And she's just captivating, right? She's delicious. I really do love and admire her as an actress. And she's doing what she can here. The problem is, it's not a good hang. It has to be. In order for this to, it's all it is a hangout show. And you have to love being around them. And the crazy thing is, they were quite good in Neighbors, these two leads. And actually, Dana, I don't feel their spark at all. I think, I have to tell you, this is ChatGPT quality script writing here. To me, it's like, okay, ChatGPT, give me a bar, you know, co-owned by a, you know, middle-aged man boy and a bunch of quirky co-workers and a nasty type A biz school wanker, you know, owns the largest share, go. And out comes all of this very stale banter. It's no better than what the algorithm can do. I know this is just mean-spirited, but I wanted so badly to like it. And I watched three episodes. I had to give up. I could not watch another minute of it.
Well, I mean, it's just, I thought it went to some unexpected places, if only because When Harry Met Sally is a reference that's dropped right at the very top, right? And there's this kind of question about the structuring premise of When Harry Met Sally about male-female friendships across two straight people. Can they hang out together without romantic interest developing? And I like that the show didn't go there, didn't problematize not going there, and regarded friendship itself and right. The jealousy that can be caused because, you know, your spouse gets really close to someone else as a friend. What happens with that? I think a ChatGPT algorithm would have generated a very different husband character for Rose Byrne than the one that Luke McFarlane plays. He's excellent as her husband. And, you know, unlike the usual sort of the stiff that a husband is in this kind of situation, right? You have to see, oh, this is why she's bored and this is why she wants to hang out with this other guy. No, as it turns out, he's this ridiculously handsome, kind, loving, affectionate partner who nonetheless doesn't provide her something that she needs from Seth Rogen. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just happy with ChatGPT pablum, but I found the dialogue funny. I found the characters endearing. No. And I liked hanging out with them for all those episodes.
Yeah, I think it's, I would like to separate myself from the gentleman's remarks. Like, I had reservations. I'm not on like team excoriation here. I mean, I think it's funny, part of what you were saying, Steve, helped bring into relief my own view, which is that when we're hanging out with Rose and Seth Rogen, I was pretty happy. And there's a scene in the second episode where they check out the fixer-upper that she's on the precipice of buying, and it's terrible. And both of them made me laugh extensively in that scene. That's like a very enjoyable hang. And that didn't feel, it's a very specific type of bad house that does not feel ChatGPT-y at all.
Yeah. This house is gorgeous. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. The butt trolls, the all of this, these details. What, 1926, obviously?
1986.
That's what I was going to say. Close. It's got the 50-year cycle.
So the interior.
That whole scene is original and good. But there was something about the world. And you're right that Luke McFarlane, who was the hunk in Bros, is great in this too. And it's fun to think of the future turns his career will take. But the milieu seemed a little bit thin, I guess. Like I agree that sort of the bar seemed extremely on point. The like selected shots of lazy. LA seem very kind of cardboard. This is the second LA mom show I've seen where the LA mom seems to walk the kid into the school in high heeled clogs. And just, first of all, you're just not walking. And if you are somehow walking, you're not wearing high-heeled clogs. Like, high-heeled clogs is a thing you could wear for non-walking. Like, just, I don't know, just like little shit like that. Like, if it's supposed to be so, if she's supposed to be such a middle-aged schlump, why is she wearing cute number six store clogs to drop off? And why'd she even get out of the fucking car? You just, you drive up and then people come get the kid out of the car. That's how drop-off works. Like, I don't know. It just felt thin. I don't know. Felt a little thin. Like, they seem so vibrant and vivid against this world that feels a little thin.
Can I, Ark, let me amend my, the gentleman would like to amend his remarks slightly. So I think this presents a problem of what standard does one apply to peak TV shows, right? These two people are so freaking talented and interesting as performers, and they've demonstrated they belong together. Why is this so not great, right? And it's, I agree, it's okay, but we're no longer hostage to the dial. We're no longer appointment viewers who are like, it's 8 p.m. and this is all that's on. You know, we live in a different world. You can swipe left so easily. So I guess I didn't hate it. I just was shocked is too strong. I was surprised that, like, the only A game on display I thought was hers, to be just brutally honest.
Well, Steve, I mean, I guess the corollary of you can always swipe away from everything is you can always swipe to something, and maybe sometimes you can't explain why a certain thing lands with you and you just like it. I just thought this show had a good spirit. It's written by a married couple, Francesca Del Banco and Nick Stoller, who've worked together before on things. And I just felt, while I could also poke holes in the world, and I agree the vision of parenting that we get is not, the kids aren't real characters. I say that in my review of it. Like, there are some holes you can poke in this. But there is something to me about that central couple that has a screwball chemistry. They remind me of an old-time screwball pair, Rogan and Byrne. Mm. They're funny together, and I, for one, stand up for platonic.
Fair enough. I was too extreme. All right, platonic is on Apple TV. It has charms. They may work upon you. They might not. Check it out and let us know. All right, let's move on.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
In the Americas, The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom is already Nintendo's fastest selling game ever. I'm plagiarizing from Luke Winkie's piece on Slate about the game and the phenomenon of the game and the premise and conceptual armature of the game. Well, we're delighted to be joined for the first time, I think, on this podcast by Mr. Winkie. Hey, welcome to the program, Luke.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. You paint this in, as someone who doesn't really play such games. This is an extraordinary explainer, though I think that's damning it with faint praise. It's like a really vividly drawn portrait of the game, and it's kind of enveloping an extensive world, but also you say that it is in some sense a covert, or maybe not so covert, defense of a free press, which that made me really wake up and pay a lot of attention. But talk first a little bit about the game for those of our audience who may not have played it or interacted with it, just what it's like to be in that world and play the game. And then maybe describe why it's such a huge hit. Which it is, correct? Right?
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Zelda kind of has a weirdly, like, esteemed, I'm trying to think of, like, a parallel in, like, you know, the non-video game realm for it. The one thing I could come up with would be something like James Bond or 007, where, you know, Nintendo has been making Zelda games since the 80s. When they come around, it's kind of like a cultural event in that scene. You know, it's a big right. deal. And there's not like an emphasis so much on continuity as it is about like the same kind of motifs that kind of pop back up that, you know, when you walk into a 007 movie, the big bad might be a little bit different or the specifics might be a little bit different, but you kind of know what you're getting into. But then, yeah, over the last couple of years, Nintendo has really kind of changed its formula with those games pretty dramatically. And I think the best way to describe to someone that doesn't play games, basically, they created a big open world that you can explore. But in other games like that, you get the sense that you're kind of walking through a lot of stuff that's been kind of copied and pasted or like a formulaic kind of way of kind of building that world of running into the, kind of the same kind of challenges or side quests. And in these last two Zelda games, Tears of the Kingdom being the sequel to another one that was like this, the entire world is a really, really bespoke. You're always running into content that feels truly authored and intentional. And the only way you can really do that is by spending a whole lot of time making that world. There's no kind of shortcuts to doing that. It's kind of like watching like a Disney movie from like the 40s or something where, you know, every frame is kind of hand-drawn. And I think that is kind of the main reason these two games have been such a big hit is that it really feels like you are exploring something that feels really kind of intentional, I guess is the best way I can describe it.
So super specific, but also vast. That's
exactly,
what's so interesting. Is 100, right. You say it's 198 miles wide. It's nearly twice the size of Massachusetts. Like roughly how long if you wanted to like explore it? You're talking a major commitment of time.
Oh, yeah. Like the attention. Not to get too in the weeds here, but there's a thing in the video game community called speed running, where people try to beat a video game as fast as possible with different kind of like categories. And I'm pretty sure I haven't looked at the records of the new game, but in the last game, the 100% run, which is to do anything, everything in the game as fast as possible, would still take you like 50 hours or something like that,
amazing.
Even if you have it super optimized. So yeah, a lot of stuff to chew on if you want to chew on it.
All right, Luke. Well, my 10-year-olds are avidly playing this game, but tell us a little bit about of that 50-hour speed run. What chunk of it would involve this interesting positive portrayal of journalism, which I think is the intriguing point of your piece? Is like, hey, here's a piece of culture that's representing journalists as, you know, non-monsters, and journalism is a worthy endeavor, which is sort of unusual in pop culture generally and definitely unusual within gaming culture and possibly even at odds with aspects of Nintendo's culture. So like, is this a little bow on a lamp in a corner of one of the Massachusettses, or is this, you know, how fundamental is this to the world?
So it's not like the main quest. It's not like you show up and to beat the game, you need to do good journalism. It's not that, you know, you're still...
Bummer. Yeah.
But it's a pretty significant side quest. You which is like jargon for just like something that's not like necessary to beat the game. You bump into this character named Penn, who is an anthropomorphic like pelican guy. I believe he's a Rito in Zelda lore, and he started a paper. I believe the paper's called the Lucky Clover Gazette. I could have that a little bit wrong. He's kind of working on the fringes to do journalism about where Princess Zelda might have ended up as she disappeared, to do some kind of gumshoe reporting about that. And he recruits Zelda. And it's a significant side quest in the game. I think there's like 10 or 11 or 12 missions just about kind of like, quote unquote, doing journalism. To be clear, our main character, Link, is not going and reporting and then going home and banging out a story on his laptop. Unfortunately, it's not quite that immersive, but yeah, no, it is like, and they've done the work to really kind of color the world with this paper. You're running into people that are reading the paper and talking about journalism in a really wholesome way, just about, you know, just people being like, wow, I learned so much about world events just by opening myself up to the written word. So it's very sweet and very cute. So yeah, no, a bigger part of the game than you might think. It's not like a throwaway thing.
Interesting. How unusual is that? I mean, I think we all have a sense of how unusual it is in pop culture broadly, which is, you know, I think pop culture is probably more sympathetic to journalism than like the culture of existing in America today. Mm-hmm. How unusual is this in game culture, though?
You know, there's definitely other journalists that have popped up in video games, but most of the time I feel like it's kind of like the sort of film noir stereotype of, you know, like almost like a private detective journalist kind of guy spilling some bourbon or ashing a cigarette or digging into some stuff that maybe crossing some ethical lines. In this Zelda game, it's portrayed so, just so wholesomely. Like, it's a very J-school interpretation of of what journalism is. It's very, very bright-eyed. And I think that is a thing that made me want to write about it is, you know, I mean, it's rare you come across, like, a video game that is just so, like, steadfast about its belief in, like, the baseline ideal of what journalism should be. And also, I will say, though, that all the different haunts for where this paper is being written, it's all in these, like, converted horse stables. So you do get the sense that maybe economically journalism might still be tough in the land of Hyrule. They're working out of, you know, like, a place where horses used to live. But, you know, they're still getting by.
Although you do see Link, the protagonist, the mute protagonist of the game, being paid all the time. I was jealous of his rate of journalistic pay. He's constantly getting violet rupees and golden horses and various layers of armor, etc. I had one question about the vision of power in this universe. I haven't actually played the game because I don't have a Nintendo, nor was I going to lay out the $70 that it cost. But I watched a bunch of Twitch streams and sort of, you know, gameplay how-tos. And it seemed like the power of Princess Zelda, who I realize is this, you know, venerated figure in the video game world, is never questioned. And so the power that these journalists would be speaking truth to just seems to be this unproblematic royalty. There's even a moment when Link is talking to one of his potential sources, I think, about going on a clue quest of some kind. And this person says, well, I wouldn't want to say anything that would make Princess Zelda mad at me. Like, they're actually aware of, you know, the princessly eye looking down upon them. And maybe it's a lot to ask of this game that it would have a vision of the possibility of the corruption of power. But I just had a question about that. I mean, about this and maybe in sort of, you know, vaguely medievalist video games as a whole, is there very much questioning of the monarchical power structure that holds it together, or is Princess Zelda just all good all the time?
Absolutely not in Zelda. There is no Princess Zelda is the paragon of all goodness in the world. Nintendo, I think, is there's been plenty of video game companies that have tried to delve into, you know, at least trying to engage with politics, something like that. Nintendo has never come anywhere close to that. I wouldn't call Tears of the Kingdom a political game necessarily in that sense. I don't think, like, Link's scoops are not like, you know, he's not like digging through the royal archive to see all the cover-ups that the Zelda hegemony has unleashed upon the world, unfortunately. Maybe they'll save that for the sequel, but yeah, that's just not really, that's not really in Nintendo's MO. I feel like as a company, they still have this idea that they're mostly making video games for like 9 and 10 year olds, and maybe someday in the future we'll be really getting into the bottom of what's going on here, but definitely not in this
Rip
game.
Rip the tiara off Princess Zelda's head.
Yeah.
So it's like speak truth to power, which is largely beneficent.
Absolutely, yeah.
Got it.
Luke, reading your piece, I learned that this there may be an element of atonement here in including a little free press parable or whatever at this center or at the somewhat near the center of their game. Talk a little bit about Nintendo's relationship to journalists, especially on the web.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, this is a problem with Nintendo. It's a problem with a lot of kind of major video game publishers, that certain people that cover the industry, certain websites specifically, certain publications that cover the business could fall under like a blacklist where all of a sudden, when it comes to getting review copies of a game, when it comes to getting invited to preview events, just like, you know, the tools we all use to cover games, all of a sudden that's kind of taken away from sites. You know, specifically, you'd probably have to ask them exactly why they did so, but around the business, around people that cover the games, it's usually if, you know, someone breaks a story about an unannounced product or they dive into, you know, an investigation of labor practices or things like that. And then, you know, without being told so, all of a sudden they're no longer kind of in the loop. And Nintendo's been guilty of that, specifically with a website called Kotaku, they did not have coverage of Tears of the Kingdom when everyone else did because they were under that blacklist. And that is, as I say in the piece, maybe the most relatable thing about Link's journey in journalism is that he has to kind of deal with the contradictions of working under the thumb of of a large corporation while maintaining his ideals. If you want to put the screws to Nintendo, they are not necessarily living by their word, unfortunately.
Luke, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about kind of cultural criticism of games and how we cover games for a popular audience. I mean, we do some of it at the LA Times. We have a games critic and a game industry reporter, but the world to cover is so vast and the amount of audience attention is so massive and really dwarfs, you know, a lot of the forms of media that get a ton of attention.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty frequent topic of conversation among people that cover the business, especially lately. We're living through a pretty rough time for games media in general. There's been a lot of layoffs, a lot of sites that have just been killed, a lot of good video game reporters that have kind of found themselves out of work. Most famously, the Washington Post got rid of their vertical called Launcher that was covering games a couple of months ago. And it's a weird contradiction, you know? You could make the argument that video games, as far as understanding the world or culture or what people are doing, is one of the most important stories happening right now. And it does not seem, especially for, you know, more kind of established kind of media entities, it does not seem that they're willing to really kind of put up the money to cover the industry in the way it deserves, because there's so many stories out there, you know, waiting to be told that have not been kind of been given the bandwidth or given the treatments or given the resources to do so. And it's something I would like to see change, for sure.
I mean, because, you know, to the extent that cultural critics and critics are kind of the remnant superego of a culture that doesn't really want to hear from them, and video game players, to paint with a very broad brush, might be the id,
right,
to have a society in which the superego and the id are not an ongoing dialogue with one another. But it's not a healthy thing. That's where you come in, Luke. This is why your task is so important. Anyways, really awesome to have you on and really talk us through this phenomenon. It's a terrific segment.
Of course. It was great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. All right. Now is the moment in the podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, I'm going to endorse something I came across in the Paris Review this week. I think this is very, very up Julia's alley as a fellow fan of fashion and fashion history. It is an excerpt from an upcoming book, or at the very least, a piece based on the material from an upcoming book. The title of the book is The Dress Diary, Secrets from a Victorian Woman's Wardrobe. It's by Dr. Kate Strasden, who's a fashion historian that I follow on Twitter. It was maybe through her that I ended up on this Paris Review site. And the story behind The Dress Diary is that Kate Strasden, this fashion historian, came across a book. I think she was given it as a gift, a personal book, like a sort of binder, that had belonged to an unknown woman in the 19th century. The date in it that it begins is 1838. And she had to do some sleuthing to figure out who this woman was, eventually figured out that her name was Anne Sykes. And she kept a diary about her clothes and other people's clothes that includes swatches of fabric from the things that she wore or the things that she planned to sew or things that other people wore. And she wrote about them and about the events they had been worn to. And this piece in the Paris Review reduplicates some of the pages from this diary, and it's just such a beautiful object of design with her 19th century handwriting and her fabric swatches. And apparently it is, you know, part of a tradition of keeping clothing diaries of this kind, but this is a particularly long-running and detailed one that really gives you a lot of glimpses into just Victorian culture and the clothes people wore and the things that they did in those clothes. It looks fantastic. Just based on this excerpt in the Paris Review, I've pre-ordered the book, which is coming out this year in the U.S. I think it's already out in Britain. Anyway, just take a peek at the Paris Review piece about Anne Sykes' dress diary, and I would be very surprised, Julia, if you would not be interested in reading more.
Oh, my God. I feel like ChatGPT conjured that out of my own brain as a thing I'm most likely to be interested in.
Completely. Yes, I thought of you immediately. It's so you. But anybody out there who likes textiles, who likes, you know, history and books and handwriting and binding of things, it scratches all those itches.
Amazing. Julia, what about you?
Well, first I would just like to crow. Let the record show that we have at this point received 4 emails from people thanking me.
It's more like it's 6 or 8, isn't it? It's not 4.
Well, I assume that each email represents between 12 and 400 individuals whose lives were changed by my heroic bravery in being willing to admit that at one recent point I didn't know you could freeze sliced crusty bread, but now I do, and I wanted to share that glory with the world. So between 4 and 1,800 people are transformed by this podcast, thanks to me and my courage. So let's see. Okay, now that I'm done with that, what did I like this week? I don't even know.
You know, Julia, I just, wasn't it that you could also freeze water in cube-like shapes and use them to cool drinks and keep them cold?
Fuck you, Metcalf. Although I did actually just see something on Instagram for an ice cube tray that will make like little ball ices that seemed good. But anyway, not buying that. I, as our listeners know, love and listen to the Script Notes podcast. And a couple weeks ago, John August, the esteemed, the august, recommended a iPhone game called Hold Down, H-O-L-E-D-O-W-N, which is sort of like Asteroid, but bit down instead of up. Anyway, very nice gameplay, good little addictive kind of mindless puzzle game that he recommended, and now I recommend to you.
Very cool. So I'm, Dana, also I'm a Paris Review endorser this week, totally coincidentally. So, I mean, as a way in, let me just say, I think it's this probably eternally open question, but it's never been more open what literary criticism is going to look like in the age of digital media. And also, by the way, I mean, also just kind of the automatic transfer of the literary canon as I knew it growing up to a new generation. Like, that's over, right? English class is no longer automatically devoted to Shakespeare, Keats, on and on and on. And so for every interesting critic, there's an answer to the question of what good, interesting literary criticism is going to look like. But I saw what I thought was an exemplary specimen, I thought, on the Paris Review website just this morning. It's called Trespassing on Edith Wharton. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know who Alyssa Bennett is. She co-hosts a podcast with Lena Dunham, a very well-known essayist and writer. It's just a direction criticism has gone in is including first person in autobiography, folding criticism into autofiction, on and on and on. This is a very short, fully beautifully realized example of some of that. I mean, essentially the author talks about her relationship to Rhode Island, specifically to Newport, where she grew up not rich, around which she grew up not rich, and her relationship specifically to Edith Wharton in the aftermath of an excruciating marital breakup. And she turns to Wharton as the one who, quote, lays bare the punitive cruelties of a leisure class, as expert at collecting things as it was at discarding people. And, you know, the Gilded Age was very real and very present to this writer as someone who grew up around those mansions. And the expectation upon the part of every stranger she meets who finds out she's from Newport that she must be rich. And it goes into her then visiting the Mount, where we did a live show a number of years ago, Edith Wharton's estate in Lenox, Massachusetts, and the excruciating circumstances around Wharton acquiring it, being trapped within it in an unhappy marriage there and escaping from it, all done in, I mean, if eyeballing it, it's certainly well under, I think, 3,000 words. It could be 2,000 words. It is very, very, very worth seeking out. And if you've never read Wharton, please, my God, run immediately to, you know, Age of Innocence, House of Mirth. They're masterpieces, I think. Trespassing on Edith Wharton. It's on the Paris Review website by Alyssa Bennett. Check it out. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
Dana, thank you so much.
It's fun, Steve.
Yeah, really fun. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Britell. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.